So my wife is an early childhood educator. And she showed me this emotions wheel one day. It was it's the greatest tool I ever had, where it focuses on your core kind of emotions, happy, angry, sad, but then it breaks it down so that you can get, okay, my customer base isn't angry. They're frustrated that they can't solve this problem. They're not angry about it. And I think being really nuanced about the specific verbiage that you use, particularly when you're trying to pick on people's emotions, is very important.
My name is Joel, and I'm a recovering nerd. I spent the last 25 years bouncing between creative jobs and technical teams. I worked at places like Nickelodeon to NASA and a few other places that started with different letters. I was one of the first couple hundred people podcasting back in the early aughts until I accidentally became an IT analyst. Thankfully, someone in the government said, "Hey, you're a nerd that talks good." And that spun me off into the world of startups, branding, and marketing for the same sort of researchers and startup founders that I used to hang out with. Today, I help technical people learn how to get noticed, get remembered, and get results. On Nerds That Talk Good, I want to help you do the same. I talk with some of the greatest technical communicators, facilitators, and thinkers that I know who are behind the big brands and the tech talk that just works. This is a special session recorded live at the Upsurge Baltimore offices following a presentation that I did to their Techstars Accelerator. Hope you enjoy it. It's with my next door neighbor and good friend, Brad Hennessy, who will introduce himself in a moment. I want to bring up Brad, who happens to be my next door neighbor, but is also a founder. I can talk a lot.
And so can I.
I can tell you all this stuff all day long, right? But it would be really probably helpful to bring in another founder who's been where you are, who has had some of these same challenges. And with some of this framing in mind, I want to just give you a little bit of the floor first. Introduce yourself. Tell them what you're working on.
See how messaging goes.
Yeah, we're going to test this messaging. So Brad, we moved in about the same time. And when I joined my startup, he founded his. So we would always be mowing the lawn and shouting and how are things going? And then when I spun off onto my world, always watching what he's going on. And I'm like, this is really exciting. It's been really a pleasure watching that grow.
Thank you.
And you've got some exciting things happening.
So I'm Brad. The company's Next Step Robotics. We spun out of the University of Maryland to commercialize technology to restore function in stroke patients. Effectively right now, patients are told by the clinician 6 months after a stroke, functionally, that's as good as you're going to get. Here's your brace. Here's your compensatory movements and things like that. Live with it for the rest of your life. What we know from science is that's not necessarily true. Brain plasticity is real. And through targeted training, you can actually not completely restore function, but in a meaningful way that enhances patients' lives. So that's what we're working on now, is bringing multiple products through development and clinical testing for that.
We did a little bit of pre-chatting. What were some of your earliest challenges? Or actually, maybe we'll go back to the story about your background and how you got to that, because it's carried through an awful lot into what you're trying to do.
And I think that's been the key to my successful messaging, is identifying the story that resonates with people's emotions on things, and at the same time resonates with their own desire for a pathway to get them to where they want. So I wanted to be a physical therapist. I ended up getting an internship with who ended up being my two co-founders at the University of Maryland, doing clinical research in exercise in stroke patients. And I got to meet hundreds of stroke patients and sit down with them, and I got to feel their pain and understand the hope that we were able to give them. So we got to touch on that emotion standpoint. We were doing exercise research, but basically what we learned that we were doing is we were making them limp faster. And so we weren't really changing their lives. We were briefly getting them in better shape, but they went home and they sat on the couch. At the same time, there was some stuff going on in the robotics development space out of MIT that was showing neuroplasticity was real and it could actually help change with this targeted approach using robotics. So one of my co-founders actually finished his MIT postdoc at the University of Maryland to help us develop an ankle robot, because the first condition we were working to treat was called foot drop. So foot drop is the inability to raise your toe while walking so you can't clear the toe. So they swing their leg out. They're given this brace for their whole life and things like that. At the same time, going for grants, understanding what grant messaging was and things like that. We were successful, but eventually that kind of dried up as we couldn't get the messaging straight in grants to show that what the next step that things needed to do wasn't incremental. We kept getting told that the next phase was going to be incremental. I didn't think taking a $140,000 robot that cost us $140,000, making it something that was less than $10,000, taking the entire shoe department that we had in our lab and making it into a device that was a universal fit and do, there's no means incremental. Incredible challenges we had to fit. And then at the same time, department chair was telling us, okay, you're not getting grant funding. Put it aside, move on to the next thing. Just throw the IP up on the shelf and move on. I didn't like that because I had the emotional connection with our participants that we saw, that we actually were improving their lives and things like that. At the same time, we developed IP that was very broad. And the robot that we developed, we saw that not only were we able to make people not just limp faster, but we were changing their entire gait dynamic and really restoring their ability to access their community. And we had really meaningful, often anecdotal, but meaningful responses from patients. So going forward, we filed for the IP of how we did that, and we got a patent for the use of our control strategy over any impaired joint, because we knew if it worked for the ankle, it would work for any impaired joint. So we had this idea, we went after it. They were doing lots of upper extremity robotics that were being successful, but it was very different than walking. And we recognized the pattern component in walking and how important that was to gain repetition. But there's no, as long as you can create that pattern in any joint, you can create that synergy to create neuroplasticity. Coming through, we got introduced to the Office of Technology Transfer, learned about the ecosystem. I didn't want to see the IP sit on the shelf. I'm a little bit of a crazy person and decided, okay, I'm going to figure out this technology transfer component on my own because no one could really tell me how to do it. Got a year's worth of basically salary, took a salary cut from my co-founders and said, I'm going to take a year. We're going to make this happen. And if not, I'll go sell insurance. That was my actual plan. So we did that. We were able to build in 4 months' time out of a startup studio, MDC, the Maryland Development Center. In 4 months, we built a device that was powered by a DeWalt battery, put it on 10 stroke patients, and got data to show that we could do this for $5,000. Build a device for $5,000 that wasn't research grade. So now we had a real actual business opportunity. Went out, pitched to the Maryland Momentum Fund, got first check. Before that, we received funding. In order to build that device with MDC, we got TEDCO funding from MII to actually build it and take it forward. So, but then we got the funding from Maryland Momentum Fund, follow on MII phase three, and then I raised $900,000 from angel investors, local as well as West Coast. But that's where messaging went in a direction. The local ecosystem told me my idea was too big, too hard to understand with what we were going after as really a robotic rehabilitation platform. And we got pigeonholed. We are now the foot drop company. I would go and I would introduce myself to people and they go, oh, you're the foot drop company. And internally, I would roll my eyes and go, yup, that's us. Because that was what the messaging that I was told that we needed to go after, but it wasn't what I was passionate for. And it definitely hit my drive a little bit. Foot drop is a thing. It resonates with people that have foot drop. Who's got foot drop? Who knows someone that has foot drop? No hands. You know, a lot of stroke patients. There's a lot of stroke patients that have foot drop. It's a big problem, but it is relatively niche in the medical space. It's not kidney disease or anything like that. But essentially, I realized at that point we had to change our messaging and go after the larger components and larger investors and things like that and try to bring in their attention. And that's, and investors don't want to fund small cap companies. You've got to be at least mid cap or larger in order to get their attention to even talk to you. And that's a struggle that we're still going through now, is trying to expand that market opportunity in a meaningful way. But yeah, we had lots of different, I don't know what direction into messaging you want me to go to.
You had a vision early on about what your big idea was,
right?
Which was the neuroplasticity across any joint, any affected joint. And then you were told, show me the case study. Who was driving you in that direction? What was the advice you were hearing to limit or niche down?
Many players in the ecosystem, one being a first-time founder, a lot of the ecosystem players that are writing those first checks and things like that are a little leery of going for big ideas from first-time founders. You have to prove yourself a little bit, and I understood
you
that.
Promise and what you can actually prove.
Exactly. And at the same time, we were going for grants, and that's where the bulk of our funding has come from, which is extremely targeted. That's our bread and butter, was always grant funding. We came from an academic center, very well funded, things like that. And we did end up honing that message for a grant that we got a $5 million grant from NIH to do our development and things. But what was really interesting, at the same time, we were the second of this kind of grant that came out. NIH and even VA funding now has equal weighting on your commercialization strategy. And I'm on a standing committee to review these kinds of NIH grants now. And it is equally weighted, your technical approach and your commercialization strategy. And what they're looking for is you to be able to explain that messaging in a way, and you can put personality in it. And I see the grants that get better scored are the ones that have personality and play on people's emotions a little bit in what is this typically ultra dry grant application, but really to explain that you have a brand and things like that. And I think the reason why that's the case is because a lot of SBIRs have been submitted to really just kind of prop up research academic directions. But they want to see that you actually have a plan to commercialize this thing. It's not something that you're just going to prop up your research approach.
So talk about the difference between writing for grants, now knowing that they're humanizing a little bit and they're a little bit more open to maybe opening up with the story and the use case as story, and then going after the angel investments.
Yeah. So grants are very technical. You have to do that. There's pretty much a flow chart that you can almost follow to get that. How I developed my pitch is I had a good team that we could pitch ideas off each other, but we were pure academics, and I realized that wasn't going to cut the mustard right away with actually pitching. So I pitched to absolutely everyone I could find that would let me pitch to them who I knew was going to say no. And that was because they were going to ask me questions, so that when I had a potential yes asking me that question, I knew how to answer it. That was probably the most valuable exercise that I did early on, was just, and I even did, everyone told me, stay away from pay to pitch. Don't go to any pay to pitch events. I put $800 out of my pocket and I went to a pay-to-pitch event in Manhattan. And I was pitching to a team that had $800 billion in their portfolios. And I got the best questions I could have ever gotten that I was able to answer, because they actually asked questions about revenue generation, recurring revenue, the things that actually matter to investors, the money component. And that made me realize, okay, this money component of a business is actually pretty important, and you need to figure out that messaging early on, because the angels care about it too.
So you're getting all this feedback, and you're seeing where their eyes light up or where they start dropping off, or the questions that they're asking. What techniques or what tools did you use to make sense of all that, to avoid chasing that messaging? They asked about this, so this is the only thing I can talk about now. Doing that ambulance chasing kind of.
Yeah, it's hard, and it's a balance, and trying to focus on having a time frame. You know, it's everyone's like your elevator pitch. It doesn't sound like it's as important as it is, but it's probably one of the most important things you can work on, because if you can explain what your business does, and not just what your business does, but how your business makes money in 30 seconds to anyone you meet in an elevator, not just the ideal person you end up in the elevator with. So anyone you meet in an elevator can understand what you do. Then you can have those conversations and those deeper conversations pretty quickly. The other tool that I used was actually as Joel talks about, talking to children and having children understand things. So my wife is an early childhood educator, and I, you know, wasn't always the best communicator, you know, as the husband, right? And she showed me this emotions wheel one day, like I was an 8-year-old, it's the greatest tool I ever had, where it focuses on your core kind of emotions, happy, angry, sad, but then it breaks it down into further syllables or synonyms for those emotions, so that you can get, okay, my customer base isn't angry. Follow that trail to they're frustrated. They're frustrated that they can't solve this problem. They're not angry about it. And I think being really nuanced about the specific verbiage that you use, particularly when you're trying to pick on people's emotions, is very important.
And that's storytelling. That is being very specific and articulating the problem that they're feeling. They may not even have the word for it, and they go, that's it, that's how I feel, I'm frustrated, you get me. And that's an instant credibility builder.
Exactly. So you should always be adjusting your message based on the audience. So it's really important to do as much research as possible on the audience that you're going to be presenting on, because they all have very specific wants and needs and emotions that they might be feeling, right? So early on, pitching to TEDCO and the angels and things like that, you want to be very specific, even to the point where you're targeting just one thing, even though you don't want to, because you have to be able to articulate a finite story that's clearly executable and that you can manage as a solo team often at that stage. And, you know, you can't say you're going to do these things that you don't have any expertise in or anything. Okay, you're going to talk to consultants, like make sure, identify your weaknesses and say how you're going to fill in on those things. So early on with angels, like I said, go pitch to as many people as possible who will say no, so that you know the questions that the angels are going to give you. And then grants, when you're going for that, it's a much more technical approach. Even the commercialization plan is 12 pages often. That ends up being a very, very technical commercialization plan. Just fill out the 12 pages and give the kind of detail. But then you're always changing your messaging. And so we had to talk to the FDA about quality control, safety, and the messaging around that and the importance for it. We filed for a breakthrough device application. We didn't get it. I think the FDA was wrong by not giving it to us. But we had to tell that story of why it's important what we're going for compared to what's out there already. And you have to change that messaging. And now we're going through where we are FDA registered. We've got a 510K application we're working on. Now we're pivoting, and I had a board member in the office for the last 2 days working with us on messaging for, okay, now we're going to be customer facing. This is completely different. And it's almost like you have to keep zooming in and out of what you do. You have to zoom, you have to show, figure out who it is, who wants the big picture, simple language, and who wants the technical stuff. Because there are specific audiences where the technical approach is the important component. But you have to figure out that zoomed out view, because even the ones that are interested in the technical, you got to get their attention. And that happens from that more top level messaging.
So now you get to go back to that founding story. I saw so many patients who didn't have hope, and they were being told, this is the best we can do. Do you think that is that going to become a lot more of that message as you're going into these clinics or you're going into?
Exactly. And that's where that, I bet you're frustrated that you can't do this with your patients. I bet your patients are frustrated, you know, figuring out what those emotions are that get them actually considering your technology for adoption. We place an extremely heavy emphasis on customer discovery, and also recognizing who your customers are is important. I'm helping stroke patients, but that's not my customer. My customer are physical therapy clinics that are going to buy this device to use on their patients. So we knew how stroke patients felt about their condition and things like that. We dealt with hundreds of them at that point. Luckily, University of Maryland has a great rehab hospital, and we spent a lot of time in our early development making sure that this was a problem that they had and there was no solution. But then we had to go and basically validate all of our assumptions that we had built around just one entity. And I ended up interviewing over 200, not just PTs, but largely clinic owners and decision makers. Because that's, again, defining the customer further. It's not even the PTs. It's the ones that are actually going to write the check to give it to their PTs in the clinic to use. So identifying your actual customer is extremely important to your messaging as well.
Did you find having that direct patient hands-on helped you advocate to the customer that second level order of benefit? Say, look, we know what you're dealing with. Do you know what your patients are dealing with? Do you find that being valuable as taking that step back? Did that come in handy?
Yeah, because what it does is it builds credibility with them. So you're able to immediately say, this is a problem your patients are having. And they go, that is a problem my patients are having. You're right. And to be able to just immediately pivot it right back to them is, would you like a solution to help your patients with that? What's cool about the iCorp program is they teach you how to do that process without talking about your solution. And it gives you a lot of information about what your solution should be. And that's when they came to us and they would say, I bet you would like a device that actually, you know, helps your patients get better. Yeah, that'd be great, as long as it doesn't take too long to set up. What is too long to set up? Anything over 3 minutes. Okay, that's my design input. It's got to be less than 3 minutes to set up and get a patient going on it. And that's, those kind of open-ended questions allow you to really feel out what the solution should be for your actual customer. So it's identifying who your actual customer is first, and then trying to be as vague as possible in figuring out what your solution should be during customer discovery, really as early in development, if not before development.
I'll throw you one more curveball. We'll take any other questions afterwards. How do you keep your creative spark alive outside of the technology? Is there anything that you do outside? Because I know a lot of founders get very focused in on the thing. Is there anything that helps you do that discovery outside of?
Just kind of like letting my creative mind like wander in things.
Hobbies, interests, things like that.
I'm a huge sci-fi nerd. And by that, I mean, I like sci-fi books. I do a lot of gardening too. I'm like a little old lady in my garden.
Jealous of his garden, by the way.
Like, you probably see me walking around the yard and like a little old lady in my garden. I walk around, I've got headphones on. I'm always listening to either a sci-fi book or really old school philosophy, like Plato, Marcus Aurelius stuff. And I think there's some kind of tie there because there's a lot of philosophy in the sci-fi. But that just often gets my brain going, and I'll have a question. I'll put on some Marcus Aurelius meditations and I'll go for a 3 mile walk and I'll come back and I have a solution pretty much planned out. I'll word vomit into ChatGPT and then say, make this make sense. And it spits it out and I can edit that into a clear, concise message.
So you're not just muttering to yourself as you're walking around. So I'm a little worried about you, man.
A little bit of a crazy person. I told you that.
At this point, we took a question and it was about feedback, but unfortunately we didn't have them on microphone, but here's Brad's answer.
The important thing about feedback is you got to understand what defines your product and what's features, right? So there's a very clear, you have to understand what will actually make a minimal viable product for this. What can I actually go to market for? First, you have to define the pain point that the customer has.
That's a card in there, by the way.
Yeah, once you can define the pain point, then you can actually define the solution for that pain point. And you have to draw the line, and you got to be kind of brave about when you draw the line to say, okay, this is good enough, because you could just develop features forever. This is where design freeze is going to happen. And then whenever you get feedback on how to make your product better, take notes, and that's for the next generation. But you really have to make sure you get that early on. It's the feedback to define the minimal viable product. Once you define it, stick with your definition, stick with your gut, because often what you're getting is the gut of the clinician. Stick with that and make something that works for them.
Yeah, quite often I'll be working with a client and I'll say, well, what are we going to put on this features page? And they'll give me a list of 14 bullets. And I'm like, we talked about the overwhelming the caveman brain. You do not want to ever put 14 different choices in front of somebody. You want to figure out a way to create super groups or to cluster together and say, here are the solution areas, and they're solved by these things, right? The human brain just cannot sort through that. You just can't give everything and say, you pick what's important to you, because it's lazy. It's just really lazy.
Yeah, the last thing I'll say is don't ever make assumptions and ask the stupid questions, because the stupid questions often give you the answer that you're looking for. And kind of that they give you that gut that of what's actually bothering your potential customer. We'll find out if what I've been working on is we're going to market now. So we'll see if you know, the pathway that I've gone through is going to work. But we've been trade showing for 2 years to kind of make sure we had an MVP that we felt good with. Luckily, we had NIH funding, so we could afford to go to those trade shows and things like that. And I think we're getting a really, really good response from our customers. I'm excited for the rest of this year.
Awesome.
Onboarded my sales director 2 weeks ago.
We need to build in the messaging playbook.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Red, for joining us. I think that was, you've told them everything that they needed to hear. So I think that was super duper helpful. Thank you guys for coming.
Thanks, Joel.
If you want links to the resources mentioned on the show, head on over to the episode page. And for information on booking a message therapy workshop, getting your hands on the message deck to check out my upcoming book, or just buy me a coffee, go to nerdthattalksgood.com/podcast. Until next time, happy messaging. Remember, you don't have to speak well. You only got to learn how to talk good.